Hi, everyone. Welcome. I think I recognize everyone's face today, and that doesn't always happen at BGMC. But, like, new people are great, but there's something amazing about, you know, feeling connected to everyone in the room. So, as Mike mentioned before, I'm going to be carrying on with the Hinterland Habit series. I can't remember what hinterland means. I don't know if anyone here can. I probably should have looked that up. So I went in on the kind of habit side of things because I do know what habit means. But before I dive into what my habit is, I wanted to start with a bit of a story. And happy Mother's Day. I just needed a filler slide, and I feel like that's, you know, relevant for today. So this is going to be a story linked to my work. Hopefully it's not too boring. For some context, I work in a community mental health team. So I do kind of one-to-one and group therapy with adults who have experienced a lot of adversity and understandably are really struggling with that in their day-to-day lives. Also, just to say, for the sake of this story, I've changed a lot of details for confidentiality. But a few months ago, a colleague came to me and she said, I assessed this lady named Lola, and she's really struggling with panic attacks, with anxiety, with some flashbacks. And my colleague asked me if I'd be willing to do kind of an 8-week intervention with Lola focused on what we call stabilization. So thinking about breathing techniques, coping strategies to manage her symptoms. When she asked, I was like, easy, I got it in the bag. This is a really kind of standard intervention for me. So I kind of do this 8-week stabilization course a lot. And I have the skills that I do. I have the sessions that I go through. So I thought this will be a fairly straightforward intervention. Lola came in and I realized fairly quickly it'd be very different. She was really resistant to the techniques. I remember in our first session we were doing a breathing practice and she... It's actually so funny looking back. So I closed my eyes as well to do it. And the whole time I'm really in the zone to kind of get the other person to connect with me. And I open my eyes and she's scrolling through Instagram thinking we've had this amazing mindfulness practice. And I'm like, oh gosh. And that pattern kind of carried on. So I'd assign tasks. I'd say maybe do this strategy every day for the next week. She'd come back, say, oh, I don't find it helpful. It's too busy. I was too busy. And as the sessions went on, I found myself getting more and more frustrated. My jaw was clenched, my fists were clenched. I was thinking of what strategies can I use to get her to implement these things. And I felt like we weren't making any progress. I was like, we haven't gotten anywhere. She hasn't changed. She hasn't improved at all. And so by session 8, which was our last session, I didn't do any prep for the session. I didn't come in with skills. I didn't come in with worksheets. And what unfolded was slightly different. Lola came into the room. She started complaining about her neighbors as usual, but this time I didn't interrupt her. And what happened was, you know, she started kind of, I guess, opening up about her day-to-day struggles in a way that I hadn't allowed her to before. And as she left that day, I felt kind of a deep sense of sadness. So it was as uncomfortable as previous sessions had been, but it felt more tragic and less maybe frustrating, let's say. But as she left, she thanked me for watching her cry. She said she hadn't had someone watch her cry for a long time, and that really struck me. It left me reflecting on how wrong a lot of our work had gone. I thought about, you know, my own need to assert my agency on the situation and get her from point A to point B in a set period of time. It left me wondering what had my impatience robbed her of, and if patience had been the defining feature of our work together, would I have been able to bear witness to her struggles without needing to assert my own control? So that brings me to our topic today, which is patience. It's funny, Chrissy, one of the first things Chrissy said to me today was that I needed to be patient. She didn't know I was speaking about patience because I was just like rushing around doing stuff. But I wonder if as I reflect on what my impatience robbed Lola of in our sessions, maybe today we can all reflect on what our collective impatience robs ourselves and others of. So sometimes we hear this kind of sense of divine patience. Hi, Callum. We'll come to church and people will talk about patience. And what comes up a lot is waiting for God's timing. This idea that if we wait, this huge main monumental event will happen in the future. It's very future oriented in that sense. But I want to shift the emphasis slightly. I want to argue that patience isn't a passive waiting in anticipation for the real or the main event that happens in the future, but rather patience is an active and courageous decision to root oneself in the present moment and experience the suffering and pain of that present moment while holding on to the hope that there's a possibility of a future greater than human imagination and a future where God partners with us. And I'm going to be unpicking this argument slightly. I have a bit of a structure. I like structure in general. Helps me organize my thoughts. So we're going to be looking at Jesus. This is my first sermon, so I thought just start with the most basic example of things. You can never go wrong with that. And I've divided it into three topics. So we're going to be looking at what did Jesus's patience look like, and in turn, what should our patience look like? Why did Jesus exercise patience? And then finally, we'll think about how did Jesus practice patience? Again, thinking about how can we practice patience? So the passage I've chosen to look at today, it might seem a little bit rogue because it doesn't say patience, or I don't even think it says waiting or anything along those lines in it, but we will get there. It feels relevant for me at least. So you can flip to it if you want. We're going to be looking at the Garden of Gethsemane passage in the Gospel of Matthew. I don't know what page it's on. I'm also going to put it on the board, so feel free to just follow along there if it's easier. So we're going to be looking at Matthew 26, verses 36 to 44. I will read this. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to read it out. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Going a little further, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Couldn't you men keep watch with me for 1 hour?" he asked Peter. "Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." He went away a second time and prayed, "My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken unless I drink it, may your will be done." When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. So, just to set the scene a little bit, I'm sure most of you know why he ended up in Gethsemane, but not all of us have been to church many times. At this point, Jesus has had the Last Supper. He sat with his disciples and he said to them, "One of you is going to betray me." This is the day before or the night before his crucifixion, his trial. So essentially he has this period, this night of waiting for all of these big events to happen. He's waiting to be betrayed. He's waiting to be tried publicly, and he's waiting to be crucified in front of everyone that loves him and hates him. And so he is kind of in this torturous phase where he's sitting around waiting for all of these various things to happen. I bet that if anyone here was in Jesus's position, they would have done maybe one of three things. They might have run for the hills. They might have, you know, hid under a rock, tried to change their identity, tried to avoid the situation completely. The second option is maybe the more courageous among us would have gone straight to Pontius Pilate and thought, "I want to get this over and done with. I can't bear this in-between phase. I know what's coming. I'd rather just get it done with early." Or third, I might have done this if I was in Jesus' position, but I might have thought, "I've turned the water into wine before. Maybe I'll just do it again and I can just obliterate any knowledge of what is to come." But Jesus doesn't take any of these three routes. He literally sits. He kneels down in a garden and speaks to God, patiently waiting for what he has to come. So this brings me to my first point. This is the what. So what characterized Jesus' patience? In this passage, Jesus demonstrates that the essential feature of patience is the ability to accept or tolerate suffering in the present moment. We have been sold a lie about what patience is. Patience has been painted as a passive process or a state that brings, you know, total calm. I have images of kind of the Buddha sitting cross-legged in this state of utter bliss. But this passage suggests that actually we're in for cold, hard reality check, because patience is not all-consuming bliss. And I think that's a lot of our experiences of it. Patience is actually much darker and deeper reality of what it feels like to be in the present moment. So in verses 38 and 39 of the passage, it says that Jesus began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death." Going a little further, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed. In these moments, Jesus is crying out the suffering that he's experiencing in the waiting. He's not even kind of being a martyr and holding it in and pretending like everything's fine. He's literally speaking to God. He's so physically overwhelmed, he falls to the ground. So he's not entering into this peaceful state of contemplation. He's communicating with God about these intense emotions he's experiencing. So there's kind of this active acknowledgement piece of the pain that arises. And I think the other side to the what of patience is what is impatience, or the opposite of patience. And Jesus shows us that impatience is asserting our own control or acting on our own will in an attempt to avoid the suffering of the present moment. So the depth of the emotional experience drives us to control. So maybe this looks like distracting ourselves. Maybe we seek to alter the outcome. Maybe we give up completely on the situation for fear of, you know, being a failure and needing to wait for what the verdict is going to be. When this form of impatience kicks in, we all have our own kind of like brand of control or impatience, our own flavor maybe. So my personal favorite is perfectionism. And I know that there's other perfectionists out there. I'm not going to name names, but I could. And this has come up for me recently, because some of you might know I've been applying to these doctorate programs in psychology. They're a very like long, drawn-out process, very competitive, and I found out 2 weeks ago that I'd been rejected from two of them, and I was waiting on the kind of outcome of the other two. And I was in this waiting game, just like Jesus in the crucifixion. Pretty much the same, I think. It felt the same. And so, yeah, I guess these emotions of sorrow, of pain, I know it sounds dramatic, but it definitely, they were creeping in a little bit. And at the time, I went straight into kind of robot automatic mode. I started applying to other jobs. I took on 3 new projects at work, which I definitely will not be able to deliver on. But I was like, yep, got this. Started waking up earlier. I made this insane Excel spreadsheet, which broke the day down from like 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. into 30-minute blocks. And I was like, okay, how am I going to maximize each 30-minute block? It was getting to the point where it was like out of control. And this was all to avoid that feeling of like anticipation, the rejection that I'd experienced, but the anticipation of what was to come. And it made me think about, what would it look like if Jesus was a perfectionist in this situation, in the Gethsemane passage? I think if I was in Jesus' shoes, I would have felt kind of the pain of that evening creeping in. And I would have thought, how can I, you know, avoid or change this feeling? And knowing that my job here on earth is to preach the gospel and show love to people, I would have been door knocking, I would have been healing, I would have been doing miracles left, right, and center. I'd be thinking, I had one job, and if I just do it perfectly or as well as possible, maybe I can avoid this space. But Jesus was not a perfectionist, and he was not impatient. He wasn't trying to change the present moment. But he does recognize that he has a will to change the outcome. So in verse 39, he says, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me." Maybe he wanted to be reunited with God in a more peaceful way. Maybe he thought, I'd rather not be nailed to a cross. He probably did. And this desperate prayer, so this prayer that his cup might be taken from him, he's expressing he has his own will, which suggests that patience isn't the absence of a desire to run, to avoid, to hide. Instead, patience is an ability not to act on that desire in order to fully experience the will of God. So again, it's not pretending like, you know, I don't have any will myself, I don't have any desire for this not to happen. It's noticing that. Something, I guess when I think about Jesus pouring out his heart to God, it makes me think back to my final session with Lola as well. I noticed a similarity between how she poured out her own lamentations and pain from her situation and how Jesus is doing the same in this garden. And I reflected on this, I guess, irony or connection that when people come to our service, we refer to them as patients with the TS. And I'd never connected the word patience, as in this type of patience, and patience that way. And it made me look into the root. So the Latin word for patience actually means to suffer or to bear. It makes me think about the parallels between Jesus's patience and the ongoing existence of many people who might be defined as patients. And I wonder if, you know, we have all at some point in time been patients in a healthcare system. And that is, you know, experience of bearing with the suffering. And I guess what I see when I read this passage, but also when I think about the people I work with on a day-to-day basis, is that patiently waiting in the suffering is not a passive act. It's not a lazy act. It's not an easy way out. It's not an indulgence in our into our emotional experience, but it is actually a divine act of courage. So this kind of begs the question, why does Jesus patiently suffer in the garden? Why was Lola willing to open up her struggles to me? Why was she able to courageously feel and lament the pain of her circumstances? And this kind of comes to the why of Jesus's patience. I also appreciate, so far I've painted a fairly bleak picture of what patience is. It's like a knot with suffering and patience all interwoven, but it gets brighter, and that's, let's call that the why being the third kind of string, and that's the string of hope. So without hope, exercising patience is very fruitless. It's pretty sadistic. It kind of reminds me of Mike's Revelation sermons. 40 Sundays in, and I was like, is there any hope here? No, they were great. I think that kind of the conclusion was that there is hope, right? Maybe. But luckily, patience isn't like that. There is hope. There is a better future. And so I would like to argue that the reason why Jesus was patient and why we should be is because we will never achieve anything beyond humanly limitations without it. So through patience, we allow God to enter into the story. We create space for God to become a mysterious and powerful agent in our lives. And this is what weaves hope into the process of patience. I wonder how many people here look back on a situation where they really wanted something to go a certain way. Maybe this was getting a particular job, staying in a relationship, a friendship, getting onto a course. And at the time, maybe it didn't go that way, and there's this sense of that the world is crumbling around you. I'm sure there's also a temptation, because I've been there, to do whatever it takes to continue fighting for whatever it is that you wanted. You see this, I mean, I have many friends, and I'm sure we all do, this cycle of relationships that can happen. You cling to somebody you're in relationship with, and you'll do whatever it takes to make that relationship work. People go through breakups, get back together. You know, it's like 12 times they've gotten back together, and you think, how have you not given up yet? But I wonder if there have been times maybe where you've approached it slightly differently. Maybe you've decided to embrace a more patient approach, sitting with the feeling of rejection or failure. And I wonder if as time has gone on, this has allowed you to have space and open-mindedness to opportunities that, you know, you didn't even consider might have existed. for me, I like to think of these opportunities as how the Holy Spirit works in our lives, mysteriously guiding us down new and more fulfilling paths that we ourselves couldn't have imagined. What for me, a great example of this is when I first moved to London, I was on this graduate scheme where we did kind of, I think it was like a 10-month placement was our first placement. And there was loads of different placements around London. I really wanted to work in a women's refuge. So I applied, it was a long application process for the refuge. There was, you know, an essay, I think two interviews, whatever else it was. Anyway, they got back to me. They said, sorry, we're going to go with someone else. I definitely felt that moment of like, oh my gosh, I can't, this, I really wanted to do this. Instead, I found out I was placed at City Gateway. With, I was like, oh, I don't like working with kids. Oh, I hear it's a Christian school. That's so weird. And for many of you, this is, you know City Gateway. For those of you who don't, it's a school for kids who have been kicked out of school. So I started working at City Gateway. It was definitely like backup option. But there I met Akram, I met Joss, so I got a husband out of it somehow. It's like, this has worked out well. I started going, I realized I loved working with young people, and that's kind of led me into my career path. And then probably most importantly, God walked into my life, not just in these subtle cues, but that is what brought me to this church. So Akram and Joss invited me to be GMC. So it very literally brought me to God in that sense. And again, drawing parallels between myself and Jesus, I feel like this story isn't so different than the Gethsemane example. So obviously I wasn't crucified, but I'm obviously joking, by the way, guys. I don't think I'm anything like Jesus. I just want to be clear. but similarly, Jesus had a desire for a different outcome. So he wanted something to go his way, let's say. I mean, slightly crudely, I wanted to work for this women's refuge. But actually, Jesus was able to consider the possibility of an even greater future, with God as the driver. So in verse 42, he demonstrates this. He says, may your will be done, and not as I will be, as you will. So despite the fear, Jesus trusted that there was a more loving, compassionate, and mysterious path that he could even imagine. And ultimately, it paid off. So, people have different interpretations of the crucifixion, but for me, that was the ultimate example of God's love for us and his desire to be reunited with us. An unbelievable, mysterious, magical, crazy act, but one which we could have only gotten to with space for God to come in. And this story applies to us as well. So God has a infinitely more beautiful picture of our own lives than we could ever imagine. Our futures are more mysterious, more mystical, more filled with opportunity than even our wildest dreams. But in order to get to that point, allow our paths to be pushed down that journey, we have to allow God to partner with us and to create space for him that involves patience. Again, sitting with the discomfort, allowing God to enter. So far I've spoken a bit about what patience is, i.e. the sitting with the suffering of the present moment, and why we should have patience, so the hope that a different alternative could come. But before I go to talk about how to practice patience, I wanted to pause so people could have a quick reflection discussion about patience. We'll probably spend about 5 minutes doing this, and then I'll get a little bit of feedback. So there's two questions. The first is, based on this kind of what and why so far, where have you noticed impatience in your life recently, or impatience coming up for you? And I would say, linked to this, what I was saying about the kind of everyone's personal brand of impatience, mine being perfectionism, maybe noticing what is your personal go-to, your favorite brand of impatience, and how might you bring more patience into these situations. So feel free to do this as a group on your tables, turn to the person next to you, whatever feels best. And we'll have about 5-6 minutes to do that. Right. So I would love to get some feedback from people. I don't know if there's any interesting points that came up during the conversation, or like particularly focused on the how to bring more patients in, especially because we're going to speak about that. So it'd be cool to see if it came up for people. Who wants to kick us off?
I think towards the end we were talking about like the connection between Kate's talk last week on solitude and this talk here, and how sitting in solitude is kind of bearing with the solitude, and how that's really uncomfortable. But actually, if you allow yourself to do it, then creative stuff will happen, and you can, I don't know, be efficient in other ways, or even just sitting and being present. So it kind of, bearing with this patience. Bearing with this period of things that are happening as well. I said how your talk reminded me of just conversations that you have with other people. Here I am, hello. And the need to, or the desire to want to intervene in that conversation and respond, and waiting to respond to what they're saying. And how a lot of the time you can, like what you did with Lola, just stop and be still. And even when that conversation does feel like it's come to a close and it's your time to reply, you can still wait, because there's more things that will come up for them. And there are actually things that people want to share, but they won't share it initially. So just sitting and allowing them to reflect and then say it can be really powerful. And we also said something else. I can't remember what it was, but
we talked a bit about the tension between patience and action. And like, because we have to do some stuff, but then there is a tension. So if you could resolve that for us, that'd be really helpful.
No. thank you. Those are all great examples. I think the conversation one is a really, really good example. You see it all the time in groups, especially, before someone's finished their story, someone's like kicking off with another story, and actually you sit on a more surface level conversation. What else came up for other groups? Maybe thinking about the how. I don't know if it feels like that's kind of the difficult part a little bit, because we know patience is good, but how to do it can be very challenging. I don't know if anyone had thoughts on that. Yeah, Caroline.
We spoke about patience. The problem we have is the focus. Like, to me and Mike, we have the same problem. Like, focusing on the now, enjoying the moment. Like, because he was saying about enjoying the now on holiday, and I have the same problem. I have to keep reminding myself. Like, I used to really run a bath, put the candle and everything, and then go in the bath. 2 minutes later, I'm out of the bath. Seriously.
Do you know why? Why is that?
Because I am someone who just wants to keep moving. I don't, when we're ending, I told my, just try taking a victim statement. Because I'm like, how you are, like, can you just tell, we'll run this, like, tell me what happened, and then I'll ask you questions. You know, the first time I want to start writing, I keep reminding myself, just listen. You know, I have to consciously do that, or I'll take a shitty statement, which is not good for the victim. They will not prosecute the suspect.
Yeah.
So I just have to keep reminding myself, so this is really good.
Great. Call it a day. Yeah, I think one thing that you said there, which I really loved, was there's patience in sitting with the suffering, but there's also patience in sitting with the highs as well, and the enjoyable moments we create for ourselves, because sometimes we just feel like we need to move on to the next thing.
That's one of the that's one of the things that we've talked about society is always moving us on. Bucket lists and things like this, Phil was saying. It moves us on to the urgent, to do, to be active, to achieve. You know, there's a sort of like a thrust to do everything with your time, achieve everything, move everything, travel everywhere, all that kind of stuff. And so that was one thing that we talked about. But the other thing is that if we're problem-fixing type of people, and we're in a job, in a situation where we're trying to help people move towards wholeness and healing, we could get a little bit of a sort of messiah complex or a saviour complex to intervene on their behalf when they're not moving on as quickly as we want them to, or they're not doing it in the way that we want them to, and you already inferred that. But I think a lot of us are problem fixers, And we're very impatient with problems and with people that don't fix either in the way that we want them to be fixed or in the time that we want them to be fixed.
Definitely. Thanks, Mike. I guess all of this, I'm adding to the Messiah complex. I did a little like thought experiment with myself the other day, and I was thinking, if I wanted to be the president of the U.S. from a very young age, if I had given everything to that. Obviously, I come from a lot of privilege as well, so there's a lot of, you know, systems we're born into, but if you are willing to give everything to something, you can probably get pretty close. I mean, maybe not president. I think there's a big luck component of that. But I guess this sense, adding to the bucket list thing, we can brute force our way to some sort of outcome that we've identified. And that's great, you know? It shows a lot of how God will actually take a step back if that's what we want. You know, God doesn't exist to coerce us. God doesn't exist to force us to do anything. Actually, God is there to partner with us through this process. So actually, if we want to do that, we can get to that point. We can brute force our way through it. But what do we lose in the process? What sense of divinity or mystery can come into our lives if we decide not to brute force it in that way? So I think everything that people have brought up kind of feeds nicely on to my final section, which is about the how. People have said, how do we, you know, Bernie was saying, how do we navigate action and patience in X, Y, and Z? And I think it's true, and I don't really have an answer. But I've come up with some steps based on this passage. And the reason why I wanted to spend some time coming up with steps of how to do this is I think habits are all well and good if we, you know, we say, okay, I want to be patient, or I want to eat healthy, whatever it might be. But unless you have a way to do that, it can be really hard to translate the intention to the practice and hold yourself accountable. So I've come up with three steps for being patient. And these steps are completely based on the Gethsemane passage. So I've kind of just copycat, you know, I've copied what Jesus was doing and come up with the guide or the manual. So if we think about the how, the first of these three steps is notice when the thought of just being still in the present moment is uncomfortable, when the idea of not acting feels painful or difficult. So this isn't necessarily just in situations of suffering. It's what Caroline said about, actually, you can set up this amazing situation for yourself, but even despite the fact that you're in this nice setting, it feels very uncomfortable to stay in that setting. Actually, it feels more comfortable sometimes to jump into maybe a higher action setting. And this is similar to when Jesus enters the garden. It's the first thing he does. He sits in the pain, in the difficulty. He yells out his sorrow he experiences in the waiting, and he notices it, he acknowledges it, and he fully feels it. There's not this pushing away. And he tells it to God, probably most importantly. So that's step one. Step two is the next thing Jesus does is he goes on to tell God what he wants to happen, what his own will or desire is. And similarly, when we are attempting to exercise patience, let's say, sometimes we shortcut to thinking, actually, I'm already patient. I don't, you know, I'm so fine waiting. It's all good, you know. We're good at, you know, there's no rush here. There's no hurry. But actually, we undermine that there is a struggle within us. There is a pull to speed things along, to avoid things, to change the circumstance. And when we don't acknowledge that, we tend to act on it, whether that's subconsciously, automatically, whatever it might be. So this is what Jesus does. He says to God, you know, I have this desire. I want you to take this cup from me. So this is also the part that, you know, our personal brand or flavor of patience feeds into. We might have individually tendencies that come up when we're being impatient. So if I go back to kind of my perfectionism, you know, the things I start noticing are over control, scheduling, waking up early, canceling plans. You know, it's all of these little behavioral habits. One thing I do is obsessive cleaning, which like is actually a really good one. yeah, the flat's clean, but I can't sit still. And we have a small flat. Sometimes I get home from work and Joss is like, I need to get out of the house. You're too much for me. And fair. I cannot sit still. yeah, honestly, I will. But it's funny because I'm not across the board clean, which is why it's a really good indicator for me, because I'm like, something has changed here. So that's what I notice when I feel the impatience kicking in, when I am struggling to sit with that. When I heard back from those two doctor applications, the flat has never been cleaner. It's still pretty clean. See, again, I'm not always the best at, dropping these things. But that brings me to the third and final step, which is in the passage. Feel free to read. Obviously, the highlighted sentences are the ones that link to the steps. But after Jesus has done, notice the pain, notice his desire to control the situation, he moves on to actively resisting the urge to control the situation. So instead, Jesus embraces the fact that an even greater and more mysterious path can exist for himself and for humanity when he creates space for God's will. And he does this through patience. We can see in this scene, in this passage, this is the step that Jesus spends most time on. So three times he goes back and he prays for God's will to be done. Three times he goes and says to God, I don't want to act on my own desire to control, to speed up, to change the circumstance. Actually, I'm ready and willing for your power, your overwhelming love and compassion to come into this situation. And I think it's really important to notice that more time is spent on this step, because I think what can happen is we can intellectually decide that we want God's will to be done. We can intellectually come to the conclusion that we are happy for, God to take the wheel, take the reins of the situation. But I think the reality is that having faith and trust in that in practice is much more difficult. And it's not an end point we reach and we think, okay, I've gotten there, I don't need to do it again. But actually it's something we have to keep going back to. And I really believe the more we say this to God, the more God comes into our life to kind of change our hearts through the process. And it's not like we need to immediately have 100% faith that, we are ready to surrender everything. But it's a conversation we can have with God, and through that, God enters in. So I guess just briefly, again, to recap these steps. First is noticing the discomfort. Second is noticing our desire to control. And then third is noticing and embracing the mysterious and even greater power that God has. And again, I really enjoy the mystical side of understanding God. And I think it's important to acknowledge that we'll never fully know what God wants for us or what it will look like when God partners with us. But we do know it will be a path with more love. And I urge everyone to think about these steps in relation to whatever situation you might have been discussing earlier. Or maybe if it's the impatience of somebody else, what steps they might be struggling with and why those steps might be difficult for certain people. And we're coming to the end. So to end, I wanted to circle back to Lola. I started with Lola. I'm going to end with her a little bit. So when I was reflecting on my work with Lola, I wondered what our work together may have looked like if I had approached it with this habit of patience. Since our sessions ended, I've started working with many new clients doing, in theory, the similar kind of 8-session program. But in my work recently, I've made a resolution not to fully conform to the impatience of the healthcare system. And I think that's worth mentioning. At one point, I considered doing this whole sermon on the impatience of systems, because like Mike, you were also saying, we operate primarily in impatient systems. And this is where a lot of the tension comes in. But anyway, I've made a commitment to myself that as much as possible, I'm going to resist this impatient. So this has looked like bringing in more flexibility. Sometimes I extend the sessions from 8 to 9 to 10, depending on what's needed. But I think more importantly, I've parked or thrown away the idea that I need to be in control of the work. I need to kind of move this person in a particular way. And I've left the space more open. It's only been a few weeks, so I don't know if I'm going to be able to keep my job if I continue down this route, because we have to collect baseline and post measures, and it'll be interesting to see what happens on those. But this newer, I guess, more patient approach has led to a lot of difficulty and sadness in the sessions. I think it's important not to think that things get easy when we're patient, because I don't think that's the case. And I think that's what happens when we bear witness to other people's suffering. But these difficult moments are so much more special than what I was experiencing before. I feel like bringing patients into sessions has allowed God to really act in the therapy room, and God to act not only on the person I'm working with, but also to act on me and who I'm becoming as a practitioner and bringing into the rest of my working experience. I came across this Richard Rohr quote. Richard Rohr comes up a lot. He's a mystical American priest. And he refers to patience as the very shape of love. And I guess in the context of my work, I really liked this quote, because I often think about how taboo the word love is in professional encounters. So, you know, you come to the NHS and it's all about boundaries, professional relationships. If you're in a meeting and somebody says the word love in any context, I think for people there's alarm bells and red flags. That's a no-go zone. And I get it to a certain extent, but I think that we've lost, really tragically lost, the essence of what it is to connect with other human beings. And this quote has really opened my eyes, because it's made me think about how we can show love to people in maybe a more unusual way or a more patient way. So again, I'll just finish by asking a similar question to that which I started. So just asking everyone to imagine how much more love might exist within your own lives and your relationships with others if you started from a point of patience. And I'm just going to pray to end. So if people want to close their eyes, they can. Dear mystical, mysterious, and magical God, we thank you for the patience you have shown us all, for this ongoing act of love which mends our brokenness with your grace. We pray that the church continues to show patience to those who need it, both within the church, whether that's the people who come to growth or the Oak Boys or the people who come for AA, and also everyone in this space. But also I pray that we continue to show patience to those outside of BGMC. I pray that in the moment when existing in the present feels too overwhelming, we're able to remind ourselves that in these moments you come and sit with us. You literally kneel down with us in the same way that you kneeled with Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, and that in these moments no emotion is too overwhelming for you. And finally, we just want to pray that our courage to actively embrace the patient path becomes filled with hope as we continue to experience, you know, the awe that you are, the wonder that you are, and the wonder of what life can look like when we allow space for you to enter into our lives. Amen.